You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. 14 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 12, given in Zurich on the 17th of December, 1912, entitled Love and Its Significance in the World. When we speak about human beings at their present evolutionary stage, being in need of an understanding of Christ's impetus, the thought may arise as to how it might be for someone who has not heard about Christ's impulse, who has perhaps never even heard the name of Christ. Will such a person have to forego Christ's influence just because they are unaware of Christ's name? Does one have to know what the Christ impulse is in theory for Christ's power to descend into one's soul? Let us clarify these questions through the following observations of human life between birth and death. Human beings step into the world. At first, in early childhood, they are half asleep. We have to learn to experience ourselves, to find ourselves as an I or ego. And our soul life is ever more enriched by absorbing all that is allotted to this I. When nearing death, this soul life is at its richest and most mature, which is why we can ask the weighty question, how do matters stand with our souls when our bodies decline? It is a characteristic, particularly of our physical body and our life of soul, that what we have garnered in terms of life experience and knowledge become ever more meaningful the nearer we come to death, and certain traits increasingly come to the fore while others recede. These vary depending on the individual. In our youth, we gather knowledge, accumulate experience, harbor hopes, which we can usually only realize later. The nearer we come to old age, the more do we begin to love life's wisdom. This love of wisdom is not egotistical, because such love grows ever greater the nearer we are to death. It grows in inverse proportion to the prospect of us profiting from our wisdom. We love this soul content evermore. Spiritual science can even become something of a temptress, in that people may think that their next life depends on knowledge acquired in this life. A good deal of egotism can accrue beyond this life on the back of spiritual science, and therein lies a danger. So it can happen that wrongly conceived spiritual science can become a soul temptress. That is a temptation in spiritual science and is integral to its nature. We can observe how love of life's wisdom sets in, like the blossoming of a plant, when the time is ripe. We can observe how love develops for something that exists within us. There have been countless human attempts to raise to a higher level that impulse of love for something that is within us. Among the mystics, for instance, we find the attempt to elevate the urge to self-love into the love of wisdom, and to allow it to bask in a good light. By immersing ourselves in our own soul life, we attempt to find the divine spark, to experience our higher self as this divine spark. In actual fact, people only create the seed of their next life from out of their life's wisdom, just like seed after the plant has gone through the whole year. Just as seed endures, so does wisdom of life. The human being goes through the portal of death, and what ripens there as a spiritual kernel becomes the seed for the following life. Some sense this and may become mystics, mistaking what is merely a seed for their next life as a divine spark, as something absolute. They may interpret it in this way because they are embarrassed to admit that this spirit seed is but their own self. Meister Eckhart and Johannes Tauler call this the God within us because they knew nothing of reincarnation. Once we take the law of reincarnation into account, we recognize the meaning of love in the world, both in its micro and in its macrocosmic dimension. As karma, we understand a cause in one life, translating into its effect in a subsequent life. As human beings, and in the sense of cause and effect, we cannot rightly speak of love in the sense of deeds of love and their recompense. It would be a matter of a deed and its rebalancing, which has nothing to do with love. Loving deeds are those that do not seek equalization in a subsequent life. Let us imagine, for example, that we are working to earn. This could be different. We could be working but taking no pleasure in it because we are working to pay off a debt rather than for wages per se. We can imagine how we have already used what we are now earning through work. We would prefer not to have run up debts but now need to work to pay them off. Now let's transpose this example onto our human behavior in general, that everything we do out of love turns out to be repayment of debts. Seen from an occult perspective, everything done out of love brings in no pay packet, but is liability for goods already used. The only transactions for which we receive no reward in future are those deeds we do out of genuine true love. This may be a shocking truth. Luckily, people are unaware of it in their everyday consciousness. However, everyone knows this in their subconscious, which is why they do deeds of love so grudgingly. This is a reason why there is so little love in the world. People feel instinctively that deeds of love reap no future rewards for their own ego. A soul must be far advanced in its development for it to experience pleasure in loving transactions, from which it will derive no personal gain. The motivation for this is not strong in humanity. Yet out of occultism one can indeed derive strong motivation toward loving deeds. Our egotism gains nothing from deeds of love, but all the more does the world profit by them. Occultism states love is for the world what the sun is for external life. No human souls could ever thrive without love in the world. Love is the moral sun of the world. Would it not be absurd for a person who delights, and is interested, in the growth of plants in a field, to wish the sun to vanish from the world? Transposed into moral terms, this would mean one has to have an interest in beneficent evolution, succeeding and struggling through into human relationships. It would be wise for us to have spread as much love as possible across the earth. What can spiritual science give us? We learn facts about earth evolution, about the spirits of the earth, about its surface and its changes, about the development of the human body, and so on. We learn in detail about what lives and weaves throughout evolution. What does this mean? What does it mean if people do not wish to hear anything about spiritual science? They are not interested in what is there. Because whoever doesn't want to know about Saturn or the nature of the sun or ancient moon also doesn't want to learn about the earth. It is lack of interest, the crassest egotism, when people do not have the interest to find out about the world. It is a human duty to be interested in all existence. Let us long to love the sun with all its creative power, with its love for the earth and for human souls to flourish. Learning how the earth has matured ought to be spiritual seed sowing for a love of the world, because a spiritual science without love would be a danger for humanity. We should not preach about love, but this love must and will enter the world by means of us knowing about and spreading what is really spiritual. Spiritual science must be one and the same as genuinely loving action and loving deeds. Sense-based love is the origin of what is creative, of what is in the becoming. Without sensory love, nothing sensory would exist in the world. and without spiritual love, nothing spiritual arises in evolution. When we practice love, when we nurture love, forces of genesis, forces of creativity are poured out into the world. Should we justify this with reason? After all, forces of creativity have had to cascade into the world before us and our reasoning. Certainly, as egotists, we can deprive the future of creative powers. But we cannot extinguish those deeds of love and those powers of creation from the past, for we owe our existence to past deeds of love. However strong we are as a result of these deeds of love, just as strongly are we indebted to the past, and however much love we can muster is debt repayment for our existence. We will therefore understand the deeds of a highly evolved human being, because a highly advanced human being will have greater debts toward the past. It is wise to repay one's debts through deeds of love. The impetus toward love grows with the advancement of a person. Wisdom alone does not suffice. We'd like to bring before our souls the significance of love in the way the world works. Love always points to our life's indebtedness to the past. And because we gain nothing from paying our debts to the future, we ourselves do not benefit from our loving deeds. We need to leave our deeds of love behind us in the world where they are, though incised onto spiritual world events. We do not perfect ourselves through our loving deeds, only through other deeds. But the world is enriched by our deeds of love, because love is the creative element in the world. In addition to love, there are two other powers in the world. How are these to be compared with love? One power is strength, or might, potency. The second is wisdom. In terms of strength, one can speak of weaker or stronger power and of almightiness or omnipotence. Similarly with wisdom, where there are stages of wisdom on a gradient up to all-knowingness to infinite wisdom. To speak of love in such graduated terms makes no sense. What is all lovingness? A love of all things. We cannot speak of escalations of love in the same way as incremental steps in wisdom or power, ascending to infinite wisdom or omnipotence. Our own being becomes more complete through such enhancements. But this is not the case if we love a couple of beings or more. This has nothing to do with the completion or augmentation of our own selves. Love for everything alive cannot be compared with almightiness. Concepts of size or increase cannot readily be transposed onto love. Can one assign to the divine being who works and weaves throughout the world the predicate of almighty? Judgments on a feeling level need to be silent here. Were God Almighty, He would do everything that is done, and human freedom would be impossible. God's almightiness would exclude human freedom. The omnipotence of God is doubtless not present if humans can be free. Does divine being possess all-knowingness? Since the striving for God-likeness is humanity's loftiest goal, our striving ought to aspire to omniscience. Is omniscience our ultimate prize? If omniscience is the ultimate asset, then each moment must surely open up a vast gulf between human beings and an all-knowing God. Humans would be continuously conscious of this abyss. Were it the case that God possessed the ultimate prize of omniscience, yet had withheld it from humanity? The all-encompassing attribute of divinity is not omnipotence, neither is it omniscience, but it is love, the quality within which no further graduated enhancement is possible. God is full of love, is pure love, is, as it were, born of the substance of love. God is pure and total love, not the highest wisdom, nor the mightiest power. God retained the love, but shared the power and the wisdom with Ahriman and Lucifer respectively. Power with Ahriman, wisdom with Lucifer. So that human beings might be free, and under the influence of wisdom, take their onward course. When we seek the source of all creativity, we arrive at love. The very basis of all life is love. A different impetus is at work within evolution, which leads all beings to becoming ever mightier and wiser. Perfection is reached through wisdom and power. The way in which wisdom and power evolves and changes throughout evolution can be seen in humanity's own development. We have been in continual development, and then the impetus of Christ appears. Christ, who entered humankind through the mystery of Golgotha. Love did not therefore enter the world piecemeal, but love streamed in as a complete, perfected unity. Human beings are gradually able to take up this impetus. The divine impetus of love is a unique and singular intervention, one needed as an impulsion for all earth. True love is not capable of decrease nor increase. Love is of a completely different nature from wisdom and power. Love awakens no hopes in the future. Love is advance payment for the past. It is in similar terms that the mystery of Golgotha stands within world evolution. Did divinity then owe something to humankind? Through Lucifer's influence, a certain element entered into humanity, in face of which what had previously been present had to be removed from it. What had recently entered led to a downward decline, to counter which the mystery of Golgotha brought the possibility of paying off all debt. The impetus of Golgotha did not come to absolve us of the sins committed over the course of evolution, but so that what had entered into humanity through Lucifer should receive its counterweight. Imagine that someone knew nothing of the nature of Christ Jesus, knew nothing about what is conveyed in the Gospels, but that they knew the radical difference between the natures of power and wisdom and that of love. Such a person, though they knew nothing of the mystery of Golgotha, is in a genuinely Christian sense a Christian. Whoever knows love as being for the paying of debts and not for future advantage is a Christian. Understanding the nature of love is being a Christian. Through mere theosophy, with its, in quotes, karma and reincarnation, one can become an enormous egotist if one doesn't also embrace that impulse of love, Christ's inspiration. For only then does one attain to the quality able to transcend the egotism in theosophy. One is able to rebalance this through an understanding of Christ's impetus. It is because theosophy is needed by humanity that it is being introduced now, but it contains the grave danger that if theosophy is plied without Christ's impulse, without the motivation of love, that people's inherent egoism will be compounded, that they nurture it even beyond death. We should not conclude from this that theosophy is not to be pursued, but we have to learn that understanding the substance of love belongs to theosophy. What actually took place at the mystery of Golgotha? We know that Jesus of Nazareth was born and developed in the way described in the Gospels, that the baptism in the Jordan took place in his 30th year, that the Christ lived for 3 years in the body of Jesus of Nazareth and fulfilled the mystery of Golgotha. Many people nowadays believe that they should portray this mystery of Golgotha as humanly as possible, believing that it is to be designated a deed within the earth, an earthly deed. It is no such thing. Only from higher worlds can what took place on earth in the mystery of Golgotha be observed. Let us once more place the beginnings of earth and human evolution before us. Human beings possessed certain spiritual forces. Then Lucifer approached humanity. And here we come to the point where we can say, they, the progressive gods, gave up their almightiness, their omnipotence to Lucifer, so that human beings could become free. However, humanity sank deeper into materiality than was intended, slipping from the hands of the progressive gods and descending further than was willed. How can these progressive gods now raise human beings back toward themselves? To understand this, we will have to look into the council of the gods rather than at the earth. It is for the gods that Christ fulfills his deed, to bring humanity back to the gods. Lucifer's deed is a deed in the spiritual world. Christ's deed also takes place in the spiritual world, but simultaneously in the sense world. No human being could have carried it out. Lucifer enacted his deed in supersensible worlds. Yet Christ has descended to earth in order to fulfill his deed on earth, and human beings are the observers of this deed. The mystery of Golgotha is a deed of the gods, a concern of the gods, a divine situation at which human beings are onlookers. The gates of heaven are opened, and therein blazes forth a divine deed. It is the only deed on earth that is purely spiritual, and it is therefore no wonder that those who do not believe in the supersensible absolutely do not believe in this deed of Christ. Christ's deed is a divine act, an act which the gods fulfill for their own ends. It is due to this that the mystery of Golgotha encompasses its radiance and its unique significance, and humankind is called to witness this deed. A contemporary witness account of this is therefore nowhere to be found, because human beings saw only the outer manifestation of it. The Gospels, on the other hand, are written from a supersensible perspective, which makes them easy to deny if one has no sense of what is spiritual. The deed of the mystery of Golgotha belongs to the loftiest experiences within the spiritual world from a certain viewpoint. Lucifer's action took place when human beings were still participants in the supersensible world. Christ's deed takes place in the midst of material life. It is both a spiritual and a physical act. Lucifer's deed can be understood when investigating the world in terms of wisdom. In order to grasp the mystery of Golgotha, wisdom alone is not sufficient. We can possess all the wisdom in the world, yet the deed of Christ remains incomprehensible because love is needed to comprehend the mystery of Golgotha. Only when love streams into wisdom, and vice versa, will this deed come within our ken, and only when we evolve wisdom into love as we move toward death. We need wisdom that has been evolved into love when we go through the portal of death, because otherwise we die if no wisdom has been united with love. Why do we need love? Philosophy is love of wisdom. The old wisdom was not philosophy, because this old wisdom was not born out of love, but out of revelation. There is no Eastern philosophy, but there is Eastern wisdom. Philosophy, in the sense of love of wisdom, came into the world with Christ. This is where we find the entry of wisdom from out of the impulse of love. It is through Christ's impetus that it entered the world. Now we must apply the impetus of love to wisdom itself. The ancient wisdom sought by the seer through revelation is expressed in the exalted words of the archetypal human prayer, Ex Deo Nascimur, from out of God are we born. That is ancient wisdom. Christ, who stepped out of spiritual worlds, bound wisdom with love, with the goal that egotism be overcome. But this had to be independent, freely offered from being to being, and it is for this reason that the era of love began at the same time as that of egotism. The point of origin of the cosmos is love, and from it egoism has of itself grown. Yet Christ's impetus the impulse of love, will over time become that which entered the world to overcome all that divides, all that sunders, so that human beings will gradually over time come to participate in this power of love. In singularly monumental words do we feel the love of Christ pouring into human hearts, in the words, quote, "Where two meet in my name, I am there in your midst," close quote. This is how the old Rosicrucian saying sounds into love that is bound with wisdom, in Christo morimur, in Christ we die. Jehovah predisposed human beings to a condition of group soul adherence, so that love would permeate blood relationships. As a personality, he lives through Lucifer. Originally, humans lived in confraternity with others, followed by a time of divisiveness caused by the Luciferic principle, which promoted independence and selfishness. Evil entered the world with this selfishness. This had to happen because good could not be embraced without evil. Through victory over oneself, human beings are offered the opportunity to unfold love. Christ brought to a humanity sinking in egotism the stimulus to such self-conquest, and through it the strength to overcome evil. Now, those divided by selfishness are being united through the deeds of Christ, making true, in the deepest sense, Christ's words to us, which speak of deeds of love. What you have done for the least of my brethren, you have done for me. Flooding back into earthly life came that divine deed of love, which will gradually flow throughout all human evolution, and despite physical forces dying back, will revivify them in spirit, because this deed is not done out of egoism, but purely out of the spirit of love, per spiritum sanctum revivissimus. Through the Holy Spirit, we will be resurrected. The future of humankind will consist of more than love. Spiritual fulfillment or perfection will be earthly humanity's most avidly striven after goal. You find this described in my mystery drama titled The Soul's Probation. Yet nobody who understands deeds of love will say of what they see in their own striving toward perfection, "This striving is selfless." Working toward refinement is something through which we wish to strengthen and support our being, our personality. Yet our value for the world is to be found in deeds of love, rather than deeds of self-fulfillment. In this respect, we can allow ourselves no delusion. If a person seeks to follow Christ on the path of love toward wisdom, then such wisdom, placed in the service of the world, is only of as much value to the world as the proportion of it suffused with love. Wisdom that is drenched in love, which both aids the world and helps it toward Christ. Such love toward wisdom also excludes falsehood, for lies are the antithesis of facts or deeds, and whoever proceeds in love without facts knows no lie. Lies stem from egoism, without exception. When we have found the path to wisdom through love, through the growing power of overcoming, of surmounting, and through selfless love, then we will also have penetrated right through to wisdom. This is the way someone becomes a free personality. Evil is the underground into which the light of love could shine. This light of love is what makes sense of evil, the position of evil, recognizable in the world. Light has become recognizable through darkness. Only a free person can become a genuine Christian. Readers aside, there is now a question about the necessary lie followed. Remaining silent out of love, an emergency lie, is always a very complex issue. Telling a lie out of love can become a necessity and can, in some circumstances, be a good deed. But it binds us in an extremely complex way. We are karmically binding ourselves to the person in question and are in fact bound to their weakness. We will subsequently have something to do with them. We will have to tell them the truth later. And later, due to the fairly unpleasant truth we will have to tell them, we will have to make amends in evolutionary terms. It is good that this is the case because when we are forced into a necessary lie, this is already karmic, that is, egotistical. A necessary lie is, however necessary, a lie and hence an egotistical act, which has nothing to do with acts truly done out of love. A streak of cleverness always attaches to a necessary lie. It is not always the result of a loving decision. Spiritual science radiates into even the smallest, most intricate details of the human heart. The end of Lecture 12.